To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Welcome, everyone, to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Heard the songs, you know what you're listening to. I'm Don, and I'm here by my lonesome. Rook couldn't make it tonight, but that's no worries, because I'm joined by a friend. Everybody say hello to Raj.
Hiya, all right.
Raj and I are together because he's done a comic called The Cancel House, which we're to talk about today. Now, I've read electronic copies of the first issue. I've actually got a lot of questions, a lot to say. But can you tell the listeners, can you give a synopsis of what it's about?
It's about a man who's a billionaire, and he's called Adam Warmbath. And but unlike your average millionaire who has trophy wives and yachts and what have you, he spends his money in different ways. And one of his things was He built 23 pubs in the middle of nowhere in the Highlands of Scotland, just because he thought it'd be great fun for anyone just hiking out there, rambling, walking through the Highlands in the middle of nowhere, and they come across a pub and it's working, and you can go in there, there's a roaring fire and everything's dirt cheap, and you can go and have a pint and have a good old time in this pub just for that reason. But he's also, because he's very rich, he's got a bit of he's got a beef on the world stage with a certain community of people, and he's got them in his sights. So the book's about him organizing something to do to these people, but which is a worldwide thing, which is the umbrella thing. But during the book, there's lots of things nearer home to him that he's got to deal with builders and God knows what else. And it's like close to home, and he's got to mess around with all this while he's trying to do the big thing. So he's working on a, you know, macro sort of fashion thing as he goes through the book. But there's 78 characters, and so a lot of them turn up, and they suddenly take over, you know, the odd ones will take over the book as you go along. So it's a great big shaggy dog rambling story. You have to read it all. I can't tell you too much more because I'll give it. I'll tell you all about it.
Yeah, exactly. How long do you plan on doing this? How many issues is this?
It's 15 issues, and I'm just at the moment trying to market the first one. By the time I get to getting the second one out, then I'll be bashing them out very quickly. So it'd be every 6 weeks or month. I'm hoping to do it once a month, but it'd probably be more realistically six weeks, because I'll have to do some fund thing like Kickstarter to have a go at each issue. Right. I'm hoping every 6 weeks or a month. Once you get issue two, then they'll be banging out on a regular basis. But the first one, I just got to get round and get people to hear about it, because no one's heard about it. No one knows who I am. You know, I'm just fresh off the off the boat. You know, I've been a comic artist, as it were, all my life, really, on and off. But I refuse to work for anyone. So I can't work for many people unless my boss is really a really good person. I find it very hard to work for people. You know, the minute someone sort of bosses me about and there's no good manners with it, I walk. And I, you know, my wife said, I'm a pain in the ass to be with. I can't take instruction or anyone telling me what to do.
So, right, well, that's
so the I couldn't even work with anyone on this comic book. I had to do everything.
Yeah, that was my question. Just let me see. When I read the first issue, I was really impressed. The whole package and the art style, it's all your own, but it's kind of, this is a bad description I'm giving, but the drawings were loose and tight at the same time. And but the whole package pulls everything together, and the color, to me, made it. You had some muted colors, and then the way you used the colors, you had some, you know, grays and browns and stuff. And when you had like a slate blue, it just popped out. It was unique. But everything worked together, and I'm thinking, well, who did the colors on it? And, you know, it was kind of vague for the credits and all that. I just realized you had done the whole package.
Absolutely hate giving anything over to someone else because they won't do it how I want to do it. So right. Even though I'm not very good at it, I'll have a crack at it. The lettering was really hard, and you'll see it in the first issue. I'm all over the place. I find it hard to read myself, but I guarantee you, halfway through the second issue or the third issue, my lettering, I've cracked it. It's very readable. You know, I've got the spacing nicely, right. And you know, but that was really hard work to get the lettering. I'm not naturally good at any of these things. You know, I'm really a cartoonist. I'm a funny picture drawer. You know, but this story came into my head donkey's years ago, and it wasn't a story you could draw with funny cartoons. So I thought, well, how am I going to do this? You know, I can draw realistically, but it takes a hell of a long time. And then there was a guy called Gary Spencer Millage. He did a comic book series called Strange Haven, and he used photographic reference. And I thought, well, that'll make it a little bit easier. So I used a lot of photographic reference with it, which was great fun because it means that I had to organise a lot of mates and go and do some photo shoots and it. Always ended up me buying them drinks and getting drunk. You know, it's great fun.
Right.
That was part of the process.
when I was looking at it, this is uniquely your own, but I kept thinking of some of the Italian cartoonists that they were running in Heavy Metal magazine in the 80s.
When I was a teenager back in the 70s, 80s, I couldn't believe it when I discovered Heavy Metal magazine, and then I discovered that came from Metal Hurlant from Belgium or France, one of them. I think it's Belgium, and it got me hooked. It got me into the European artist style, you know. And what's his name? Mobius. He was a great influence.
He's my favorite.
Yeah, I living in LA, I worked for a little Chinese fella in Topanga Canyon who ran an animation studio, and he gave me a job there. And but his best mate was Mobius, and Mobius just turned up in our studio one day, and I was like, wow, it's Mobius.
Wow.
And him and me boss went up into the mountains to do some channeling, which I didn't even know what that was at the time. But they took a big old sword with them, and I thought, you crazy pair of puckers, you know, I don't know what you're up to. And then later on, I got to know Mobius a little bit, and he invited me to a party in his ranch. He had somewhere, I don't know where, it was outside LA somewhere. It's a big old drive. Past Topanga Canyon somewhere, I honestly don't know where. It was full of French people though, so I was stuck there with very few people who could speak English, and everyone's speaking French, and I don't know if you know the French won't speak English to you even if they know it. You know that they can speak English, you can tell by talk when you talk to them, they know what you're saying, but they refuse to let you know that they speak English. So they just keep battering away at you in French, and you fuckers, you can speak my language. Right. In fact, I worked with the colorist for Mobius. She worked in the studio with me. She was French. She was a French girl called Florence, and she couldn't understand my accent. I mean, she spoke English, but she learned it by living in LA, and so she learned it from Americans. So when I turned up speaking English from Britain or England, she just couldn't understand what I was saying. So I had to speak to her with a French accent and she understood me, which was weird. So no. I used to say things to you, would you like me to put on your Peter Gabriel CD now, France? And she goes, that'd be great, Rog. Yeah. But if I spoke as I'm speaking, I cannot understand a word you're saying.
No, that makes sense. I'm a bit.
She was the colorist for Mobius, and his party was shit. It was rubbish. There was no alcohol. There was just all through the whole party. I went rooting around his kitchen, and I found a six pack of beer, and I nicked them and went around the back and drank them. Well, I hid them around the back, put them in some water in around the back, and made sure no one else could find them, just to have I'm English, we drink, you know.
Yeah.
when I came to work in America, it was 1990, and I come from a culture where at lunchtime, not so much these days, it has changed a lot, but back in those days, anyone in England, you know, whatever job you do, you go down the pub for lunch, you know. Yeah. If you can, you go down the pub for an hour for lunch. And so I was in Topanga Canyon, and I would bugger off to the local store and get a few beers for lunch, and all the Yanks and all the everywhere, they all thought I was an alcoholic, because I'm not an alcoholic. I've got no alcohol problems whatsoever. Never have had, still never have had, but we like a bit of a beer at lunchtime, you know.
Yeah. your ships serve beer too. When I was in the Navy, that's something, when I talked to British sailors, I thought they were pulling my leg, but they have bars on the ship. Like, why? Yeah. Yeah, we have two. Well, if you're caught with NyQuil on a U.S. ship, you're busted. You know?
I'll tell you what, our culture is drinking, you know.
Yeah.
When I was 8 years old, I was at a party, and we all got dressed up. It was in the early 70s, and we all got, you know, all the kids went around someone's house. And the mother of the boy whose party it was, she was out playing bingo instead. So she left her husband to sort of look after the kids. And he wasn't kiddie friendly whatsoever. He was a Welsh miner. And so his thing was, he gave us a big old tub of water with apples in it. He said, "That, you know, here you go, entertain yourselves. I'm in the kitchen listening to the radio, drinking whatever." And he said, "Just don't make a noise." And over the course of the evening, we were making noise. And he said, "Well, that's enough." And he came out with two big flagons of cider, and he put them down, and he poured us all out half pint of cider each. And he said, "All of you buggers, drink this up." And we did. And then he refilled us, and he said, "Right, have a drink of that. It'll make you happy. But keep the noise down." And he went back in the kitchen, and we got pissed. And then when our parents turned up to pick us up, no one batted an eyelid. We were 8 years old. All of us were pissed, you know, falling around the front garden, laughing and giggling. And in the villages where I grew up, when you're past 10, you sort of saved up your money to give to the 14-year-olds. Who could go to the hatch in the pub, and the 14-year-olds would get some cider from the hatch, and then they would give it to us, who had saved the money to give them. You know, we couldn't go to the hatch. We were, you know, underage. We were less, you know, 13. You know, they ain't going to serve a 13-year-old, but a 14-year-old can just about get by. And so they'd get the cider out of the hatch and give it us, and we'd go over the fields and drink it. And by the time you're 15, 16, they let you in the pub. And I remember... I was 17 once. I was in a pub, and And I had to leave at 10, and I was just leaving the pub, and this bloke at the bar said, "Oi, where are you going?" He said, "You're going home early, aren't you?" I said, "I've run out of money, mate. You know, I'll see you later." And he said, "Get back in here, I'll buy you a pint." And after I finished that, he saw me finish it, and he was still sat at the bar. He went, "Oi!" And I went, "Oh, hello." And he said, "There's another one here for one for the road." And so, cheers, fella. Thank you very much. And he was the local bobby. He was the policeman of the village. He was the one who stood me 2 pints because I didn't have enough money.
So that's really nice. Wow.
So, and that's, I know it's different in America. You know, when I went over there, I think I was in somewhere like Washington State or somewhere. And I went out drinking with a load of girls. And we were down this road, but the road was split between the two states. I think it was Washington State one side and another state. I don't know which one.
Oregon, probably.
But you had to be 21 to drink one side of the road and 18 to drink the other side. And I thought, this is fucking ridiculous. Do excuse me swearing.
That's
sorry.
Okay.
And it was just balmy.
Yeah.
When I got to the Grand Canyon, I was 25 and I was with a gang of, well, there's five of us, and we were like 25, 26, 27 years old, you know, a couple of girls and three blokes. And we got to a bar after driving all bloody day in Death Valley and the car buggering up and screech. Well, we thought we'd go home in the train because the car was buggered. And we went into the bar and the guy behind the bar, we ordered drinks and he said, "I want to see your ID." And we all got our, because we've been in LA for so long, after about a month, we just got these little Californian ID cards. And so we all got our Californian ID cards out and said, "There you go, this is our thing." And he went, "You're in the state of Arizona now. I can't accept these cards. I'm not serving you, you know." And he goes, "Are you fuck? We're well over age." And so we went out to go across the. We got drink in the end, but the difference between the strictness of the rules that are found in LA was just, I couldn't believe it, you know.
Yeah, it depends on where you're at. It's the same way. You go from state to state, they'll change. Sometimes cities within a certain state are different.
Yeah. But well, I was in New York when I was 17, and that was back in the 80s, and I managed to get a lock in an Irish bar at 17. That was a good night.
Wow.
I thought I was going to be raped. I was just surrounded by I don't know. There's a weird feeling in that place, especially when they put. When I got into the pub, there was just blokes drinking at the bar. I don't know if you've ever been to England or whatever. Oh. I don't know, John, but pubs in England are like nothing else. You have in Ireland and Wales and Scotland, they're like nothing else in the rest of the world. And I don't know what it is, but everywhere else in the world, it's a bar. It's not a pub. Right. You might have an English pub in America. You might have something called a pub, but it ain't a pub. There's nothing about it that's a pub like you get in England. You know, I went to I was in France in a town called Carcassonne. It's got a big old castle there. It's a famous one called Carcassonne Castle. And we spent a week there. And we're going around all the bars in this little French town. And I counted how many drinks that we had as a choice to have. And there was six lagers and one Guinness that was in an Irish bar there. Mm. And I was it. There was seven drinks to choose from, beers, you know. So it was six lagers and one fizzy stout, which is not even a proper Guinness. But in just the old town of my town, there's the choice. There would be a choice of about 500 different drinks you could have, pints. You know, and that's just in the old town of the town. There'd be about 500 different drinks, beers, 500 choices of all sorts of beautiful beers. And that's what you get in pubs. Any one pub will have 20, 30 different choices of beers, you know, of various drinks.
Well, they serve food in pubs as well, correct?
Yeah, and kids going pubs. I mean, you grow up going to pubs. You're in the villages, you'll always see kids in the pubs. You know, maybe late at night that they'll be kicked out. But in towns and cities, you might get away with a kid going in there in the afternoon, but no kids are allowed in the evening, really. But in the villages, that's what families do. They go to pubs for a meal or go for a drink, and the kids go out in the garden and play, and they have their little shandies, half a beer, half a lemonade, and what have you. And so you grow up with it, and I don't think that happens in America, do you? You know, you don't take your family to a bar, do you? No. I don't know. Maybe you do. I don't know.
No, it's the completely what everything you described is what I've heard. But it's not the same. Maybe in some places in the United States, but no place I've been to.
Yeah.
But well.
Yeah, all the bars we went to in LA and everywhere else, it was a proper bar. You could not see a kid coming in, you know.
Yeah, well, it's illegal.
Well, yeah.
But well, coming back to your comic work, was this done conventionally, or have you done this digitally, or is it a mix of both?
I don't know what you mean by conventionally, but I probably didn't do it conventionally.
Pen to paper? Was it pen to paper? Was it done?
I did everything. Yeah. Pencil and paper and inked it. Yeah. And then I scanned in the ink pages and I colored it on Photoshop.
Yeah. It's the same way. You did that on pen and paper.
Sorry?
The lettering. It was that done.
I did the lettering, pen and paper. Yeah, I didn't type it. It was all hand done.
Nice. Yeah, it was, like I said, I really enjoyed the whole package and reading it. I had to, after I read it, I went back and read it a second time. Because there was a lot to take in. And you're not afraid of space. When we were talking about space before we started recording, but what I mean is you let the story kind of breathe. And I got a little lost at one point, and when I went back and read it a second time, I kind of found the rhythm to the story, how you're writing and how you're showing the pictures. It was almost like a song. And I thought, well, this is really sweet. And when I finished it, I was thinking it was a self-contained story. And I thought, this can't be. And, you know, later I read in the book that there's more to come. From what you told me on the show, it makes perfect sense now. It's a beautiful book. And it's a unique book. And it's...
Thank you very much.
No, you're welcome. And it's thank a very...
I have absolutely no conception of how it would be read or whatever, because I wrote it because I wanted to write something I would like to read, but I can't read it because I know what's going on, you know. So shot myself in the foot, really.
Well, yeah, you're familiar with it. It was neat. It's been a long time since I've read anything like this. You know, in the 70s. There was a lot more experimentation with alternative and underground work than the mainstream comics. And I don't really see too much of that. Are you familiar with American artist Jeff Jones?
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
It made me think of his trip Idle that he did for National Lampoon.
Yeah, I've got his book up there, Idle. Beautiful. The drawings of the women are just... Wow.
Yeah.
And the weird little stories. Fabulous.
Yeah. Well, that's I really enjoy. Well, I love his drawing, but I loved how he told the stories, and they were always one page, but he wasn't afraid to have a woman talking to a chimpanzee, and then there'd be one massive panel with nothing that has to do with the strip. You know, the characters aren't in it. It'd be like a set of animal bones and, you know, a rock, and it gave a rhythm to that strip that I hadn't seen anywhere else. And when I'm reading, you know, The Cancel House, it made me think of Jeff Jones as far as how the story goes and telling of it. And I'm like I said, I always try not to spoil what I've read for people listening. But when he's talking about the pub, that is one of the sequences in it, was some people find a pub out in the middle of nowhere. And I was a little disappointed when I didn't find anything else out when it was finished, because when they find it, and they even make a comment about this is the beginning of a horror movie or something. And I thought, yeah, and most of the horror movies you saw in the 80s, they'd find someplace and you're thinking, don't go in there. And the book wasn't...
Mine's the opposite. Mine's the opposite. These pubs you want to go in, it's lovely.
Well, but you didn't tell us this in that first issue yet.
There's lots of stuff to come, you know.
Oh, there's so much to come. There's so many different areas and so many different people. But there is a rhythm to it.
And there's even one bit, I don't know what section it's in, that there's a whole, I don't know how many pages of it, on sperm wars. it does it's not just chucked in for no reason. There is a reason for it, and it fits in with the character's trajectory and what have you. But there's a whole... I suddenly sideswipe the reader by taking you into a sperm war, which is I won't even say anything more, because that's, you know, you can look forward to that. But it's a fascinating thing of what sperm do inside when there's multiple groups of sperm inside the tubes, the entrance, and God knows what else. Anyway, that's something to look forward to, maybe.
Yeah, it's as I said before, the individual components of the book aren't as strong as the whole. When you put the whole thing together, I guess the closest thing I think of, if you had a drummer playing a 4/4 beat and you had another drummer playing a 3/4 beat at the same time, it would seem haphazard, it seem a mess. But the 12th beat always lands at the same time. In reading this, that's basically how I felt. I'm reading the 12th beat. It's like a lot of different random things coming together, even to the point of... The drawings had a looseness to it, but it also had a tightness. And when you see the whole package with the coloring, it looks really tight and, well, not rigid, but it seems like a cohesive unit. But then when you start kind of looking at the panels and you see some of the drawings kind of, you know, are sketchy, are kind of loose, but when it's all put together, it's something special. And, when I hear you talk about it, I'm thinking, well, I think when you're finished with the 15 issues, I think this is going to be something to behold. There is a rhythm to the storytelling that, I, like I said, it's unique, and I haven't seen anything like that in a long time.
Well, thank you very much. Like I said, I have absolutely no... I can't even imagine the reception this thing would be. I've no idea. You know, really? All I tried to do is do the best I can. I'm pleased with it. You know, I've spent 14 bloody years on the bugger, and I've loved every minute of it. I've poured my heart into it, and I've loved it. You know, and now it's going to spend a few years promoting the bugger. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, rather than, you know, all I want to do is carry on drawing, but, oh, Christ, there's so much to do just to, you know. Because yeah. I mean, you probably know the comics industry. If you get published, I've been published before and what have you, and there's no money in it. There's no money. And so I thought, if there's any money to be made, I'll have it. I want it, you know, because even a distributor will take 30%. You know, of any price of a comic, and a publisher, if you're lucky, they'll give you out, you know, 50%, if not, or 40 or 30. And at the end of the day, you're left with bugger all, you know, absolutely bugger all. There's nothing coming your way at all, you know, if you publish. So I've had to go down the self-publishing route, as well as do everything myself on the book, self-publish it as well. And it's not a vanity thing, you know. I believe in this thing. Well, is it a vanity thing? I don't know. Maybe it is.
Well, it's something close to you. I never call any of these things vanity projects, because you have something to say and you're trying to get the thing out there, and it's not, you're not like copying a commercial property somebody else has done because you're trying to bandwagon on it. This is unique and personal. So I would never call it a vanity project.
No, I'm not. Yeah, I don't even really know what a vanity thing. I don't know.
But you said it, Raj.
That's the main thing is try and be original. It's taken a lot. I'm an old bugger, so I wanted to live first before I actually did anything. When I was young, I got nothing to say. I don't know anything. I've got bugger all to say. I might get a draw, but I want to do everything. But I've got sod all to say. I don't know anything. I know a little bit now. So I've got something to say, and we'll see what happens. I'm pretty sure no one, even if I took it to a publisher, no one would touch it with a barge pole. I'm pretty sure of that.
Probably not. That's one thing we've been talking a lot of. The show wasn't built to talk to creators. We've been enjoying it. But, it was basically just four of us that were hanging out and talking about comics we read and what we liked and, artists we liked. Yeah. But since we've been doing with a lot of creators that have been coming on, Rook, who is absent tonight, he's completely stopped getting mainstream comics. He's been completely supporting Kickstarters, I can't remember the other support systems, but
Indiegogo or something.
Patreon. Yeah. A bunch of those.
Something like that. Yeah.
But the thing is, what I really enjoy is the diversity. Everything is so different. And like, we've had a few people that have done, a Western, a cowboy kind of comic.
Sure. But
every one of them are completely different than anything I've read before, and even different from each other. We've had a couple of creators have done comic books about the North American Bigfoot. Again, completely different projects, but they all have a different twist and a different personal feel to them. And it's just one after another. So when people talk about mainstream comics and comic shops in trouble, well, it's not what I'm maybe that world, but comics are everywhere. And you go into bookstores, they have comics that I don't read, but they're comics for young kids, which makes me happy. And they're making comics for young adults. And of course, you got all the Japanese manga everywhere, but comics are everywhere, permeating cultures. But this one, it's another unique one that like you said, a mainstream publisher possibly wouldn't touch. They might once you're finished with the whole project. But how are your plans on getting this out there to the readers? Or do you have any plan, or are you just go?
A little bit of magic. I do some magical rituals every single day, whether they'll work or not, I don't know. I've got a sigil going. My visualization is word of mouth, and doing what I'm doing now with lovely people like yourself, trying to get a chat going with people around the world and hope to spark some interest. I got nothing else. I haven't got any money for marketing. I got a reasonable amount of money to get the buggers printed. I can do that. And the plan will be is once the 15 issues are done, if it's got a modicum of success, then obviously I'll be printing the big volume, as one. A few years later, not immediately, but I'll do another big old campaign and put the book out. Even if it's not that successful, I'll probably save up the money and just print the bugger out because I want to see it as a big book, right, as well. But I like it as a serialization. I mean, it's written as a serialization, so it is. Yeah, it's, it, it, it's a mad old balancing act with it. I mean, it's 360 pages long. Yes, you know, it's 360 degrees in a circle, and so I like to play with geometry and so forth, and add all these. I mean, there's so much chucked into this book from all sorts of different directions. You know, I'll even tell you this. I had the skeleton story. It's just a little skeleton plot. Yeah, so it's a skeleton, and that's what I drew. I drew the skeleton, and as I was drawing the skeleton, you know, the skeleton had different bones over here. I would go off and put different bones over there. But it was just a skeleton, and so I would draw the pages with blank speech bubbles in and blank information captions or whatever you want to call them. And then when I got all the black and whites like that, I had it all in front of me on the floor, 360 pages of these, and I had to put them in some sort of, there was no order to it. I had to put them in some sort of order. And then I thought, oh, I better write this fucker now. And so I spent 6 months utter joy with a page in front of me. I got reams and reams of notes, books and books and books of notes of conversations and speech patterns and got all sorts of things, and I had just the most amazing time. And I know there's something weird out there, because the minute you say right, I'm about to write this, I don't know, the universe suddenly turns a tap on of creativity, which. Yeah. Which all I was doing was drawing, and this great big tap of creative writing was not turned on. It was just the drawing, making the drawings as interesting as possible, making it, you know, quirky, I don't know, whatever, but just making it look just right, black and white. And so when I decide, right, now I'm going to write the buggers, I got a caption here, what am I going to put in here? And I don't know. So it's like up in the universe, someone turned a tap on, and you're just flooded all day long with, you just can't do nothing. You can't go and do something else because, oh, for fuck's sake, I got to go and find a bit of paper and pen somewhere. I got Jesus Christ. In the middle of the night, it's worse because you wake up and there's a whole bloody scene that you're going over in your head, and you've got to lean over in the dark and write it on a bit of paper. That's almost intelligible when you wake up in the morning, especially when you've written over the same thing several times. It's just a fucking mess. But it was fabulous fun. So sometimes you just have to say, just fucking leave me alone for a week. Give me a week off so I can just enjoy life, you know, without constantly thinking about writing. but it was brilliant fun. So the story went in all sorts of different directions the minute I started writing it, you know, and it's nothing planned at all. You know, like I said, you got a skeleton sort of plot. This happens, that happens. But as for the story and what and the rest of it, I don't know. It's serendipity. You came in and just chucked everything together. And it was just pure fun. If I'd written the story beforehand and drawn it, I'd been bored out of my brain after the first page because I know what's going on.
Right.
And that would have killed every bit of creativity in me. But until the very last bit of colour that went on, I didn't know what the fuck was going on. Didn't have a clue what was going on all the time. And I loved it. I loved the, what the, where am I going? I don't know where this is going to take me. But at the end of it, it all ties together. How the fuck did that happen? There's no plan. How did that happen? Because it does all. Everything is tied together. There's not a wasted frame in there that isn't added to the story and the plot and what have you. But there are 78 bastard characters that have to interact with each other. So
you mentioned you've been published before, you've done other comic work. Is that as an artist, or have you written as well in comic strips before?
No, I've written and drawn. Yeah. I can't work with anyone. I had a story. This was donkey's years ago, in the 91, I think it was. I did a I think it was a 78 page graphic novel, just to prove myself I could do it. And I think there was a comic group called Calibre.
And I
don't know who the bloke who ran it. And he was the first person I sent it to, and he said, I want to publish your book. And I thought, bloody hell, this is easy. You know, the first person to send it to, they you know. And he said, but no one knows who you are, so would you be willing to draw something that someone else has written? And I said, well, I'll think about it, you know. And this guy sent a script through. This is the days of fax machines before computers. Yes. He sent this big old fucking script, and I read it, and it was just dire, utter. Yeah, it's the same old bloody story that you've seen in comics umpteen bloody times. You know, goodies, baddies, and the fucking goodies win in the end. You know, same old fucking shite. And it really fucking annoyed me that he sent me this, because it's appalling. And so he rang me up and he said, oh, what do you think of the story? And I was young, I was a bit rude and a bit stupid, and I said, that's just fucking rubbish, you can give me something else. And he said, why is it rubbish? And I went through it, so telling him why it was awful. And then when I finished my rant of how shit the script was, there was just silence on the phone. And then I twigged up, oh shit. I said, you wrote that, didn't you? And he went, yes, I did. I said, you ain't going to publish me, are you? He said, no, I am not. And he threw the phone down. And I thought, I shouldn't be like this. I should be a bit more diplomatic in the future.
Yeah, it's youth.
And then I put that story away for years. Found a lovely woman, got married, had a family, and sort of halfway through the family, a few years into my son's life, my wife said, "Get that bloody story out of the attic and do something with it," you know. And yeah. So I did. I got it out. Sent it to what were they called? There was a really nice publishers, but I can't remember what they're called. They were known as the nicest publishers in comics. Yeah. Mark Smiley was the man who ran it all, and they published it. Straight off, they published it. But I never saw any money because I stupidly signed a deal and looking at the small print, you think, why did I rush into that, you've asked, you know. And never saw a penny, you know. They were all earning off it, you know. They were saying, we've just got someone to write a script for a film to make from your book. And I said, well, I could have written a bloody script. I know how to write scripts, I know the format. Oh no, we've paid someone else to do that. Well, these people are making money off my book, I'm not earning a penny.
What was the name of the book?
What were they called? Archaea, that's it. Archaea, that's the publisher.
Okay, yeah.
Archaea, yeah.
What was the name of your book?
That was called The Black Charity.
Black Charity, okay. Wow. What year was this?
It was under a different name. Yeah. The name was Bowspear.
Oh.
Yeah.
What year was it? Did this come out? Do you remember?
No idea. Maybe the early thousands. I don't know, 2002. I honestly cannot remember. Yeah. I know I wrote it in the early 90s, and it was a big old long time before it got published. Right. Maybe 2005, something like that. I honestly don't remember really. Oh, took me 14 years to do this one, and I did it after I got it published. So it was about 15, 16 years ago it got published, something like that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow. That's impressive.
It was just like I said, it was something I did when I was like 26, you know. Yeah. Didn't have much to say, you know. So I wouldn't recommend it. But it's called The Black Charity. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, the main thing is,
after you know, doing that, I thought, fuck me, I can do something loads better than this. And so I went.
Well,
I was going to do a little short book, but it's like I don't know, something takes over you. The story, this is what I found. This story wasn't my story. It's like I was channeling something.
Right.
It's very hard to describe unless you've written yourself and you've got into that state. My wife's writing a thriller at the moment, and she said, "Oh my God, all that stuff you told me about when you get writing and stuff suddenly starts chucking into your head." She's having the same experience, and she said, it's as if I'm not writing it, and it's just a magical experience, and I love magic. I love the magic of the world. You know, the world's shit and fucking horrible, but there is a beautiful magic to the world, and I love that, and I love being a man in this world. You know, fuck being an artist. I'm a man first, so I'm a husband, and I'll be the best husband, and I'm a father, and I'll try and be the best husband and father I can be. I'm a man first, you know, and being an artist is secondary, you know, and I hate it when people are just have this conceit of being a fucking artist at the detriment of their families, being their musicians, whoever they are. You know, it's that their narcissism and their ego goes first, because, oh, I'm an artist, I need the space. Fuck that. No, you find space in between being a man, being a real fucking man, and doing the right thing, you know, or woman doing the right thing as a woman, you know.
Right.
Sorry, I'm ranting a bit. Sorry.
No, it's fine. On your comic, we're talking about, you know, getting the word out and stuff. How can people find this? Because is the first issue out yet, or are you still?
Yes, the first issue is out. I'm on. My wife deals with my social media, because I just can't, you know, work my way around a computer apart from Photoshop. The little I know about Photoshop, right. That's all I know. I'm shit at Photoshop. I haven't got a phone. I've made 15 calls in my life on a mobile phone, because my wife made me have one for whatever reason.
Right.
I haven't made a call on them for 4 years now. But so she's on social. I'm sure it's on. I'm sure there's a Facebook page. We haven't got a Twitter. I know that. The Instagram, there's something there. But the website is thecancelhouse.co.uk. And the Council House is a play on there's housing in this country called council houses, so it's a play on that. I think in America you call them projects. It's welfare housing, you know.
Yeah.
I don't really know. I'm pretty sure they're called projects or welfare. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what it is. But over here it's called council houses, you know, but not council, but council as in the local council. So it's a play on words of that. I can't remember what you asked me now, sorry.
No, we're talking about, you know, how can people find the work? Do you have them digitally as well, or is it just printed?
Yes, on the website you can read it digitally for free. Yeah. You won't get the actual. We sent you the PDF of the actual comic with all the extra pages. You know, on the website you won't see that. You'll just see the story. You know, you'll see the story. You can buy the PDF or you can buy the actual copy. We'll post it out to you. We still got the first 100 of them. I've waxed, stamped it with the sigil, and signed them. The first 100. So and it's printed on. I've got it LIFO printed. It's extremely more expensive than an ordinary printed version of a comic. But yeah, after spending 14 years on something I loved doing, and I just wanted to give it the respect that. You know, to carry it on. I wasn't going to get shit digital printing, so it's LIFO printed. So when you take it out of the plastic, you're going to smell that LIFO ink, that beautiful ink sunk into the pages.
Right.
So, there you go.
Wow. Now, when you're, say, if someone in the United States is buying the comic, shipping, Is that added in? Is it going to be real expensive?
It's 10 quid for a copy, which is £10. What that is in dollars, I have no idea. I don't know what the exchange rate is. And there'll be a little bit extra for shipping.
I got you.
It'll all say on the website. You know, my wife set it all up. I haven't got a clue what it all says. And if I did look at it, I'd still be in the same boat. I can't remember stuff like that. It's that technical detail. She told me what to say tonight, and I won't remember anything you've said, Dave. You know, I'm just going to go into it without a thing in my head, with a blank head, and I'll chat with Don, and hopefully it'll all sort itself out.
You know, we'd be so lost without our wives. I hate to say that.
Oh, Christ. I'd be utterly lost without my wife. I've got such the loveliest wife. She's half of me, you know. So this book is half of her, you know.
You dedicated the book to her.
She's the most fiercest critic going. You know, I mean, we sit and watch films and series. She will pull apart any plot in a story. God, I couldn't get away with making a mistake anywhere. She would be on my back like a fuck. You know, you cannot do that. That doesn't make any fucking sense. Oh, okay, but sorry. Yeah, you're right.
That's what you need, you know.
So fierce, yeah. And I love her for it. She's a pocket rocket. That's great.
Outstanding. All right. So everything we talked about will be on the blog. So if you're listening to it, I'll have the links that he's mentioned. We'll have examples of the book and any information if you're interested to find the book. I actually look forward to more of this. Again, the project, I think, is fantastic. I was really looking forward to you coming on and talking about it. I do apologize to everybody for my voice. Just a funny story. We had to postpone the episode because one of us had, all the pollen in the air is just killing us. It's the time of the year. I had to postpone the second time because I had it, as you can still hear my voice. And tonight, getting ready to do the show, Rook has it. So I don't know. Either the spirits didn't want us to do this episode. Or whatever, but the three of us are all intertwined together now because we've all gone through the same thing before we recorded.
Well, neither of us coughed at all through the whole
Well, I did a big one, right?
Which was great. We had a character on the telly when I was a kid in the 70s. There was a TV program, and it was just bizarre. It was the 70s. Punk rock was on the thing, and they had this mad old TV show on Saturday morning for kids where they had this puppet cat called Cough the Cat. He was brilliant. He'd do fuck all through the, he'd just to be there all for 3 hours of this show, just sat there, little pink cat, just looking around the studio, and you'd be just obsessed with him because you're waiting for him to have a cough, and he wouldn't, and it'd be weeks and weeks and weeks, and every now and again he'd go and it'd be, oh, he's coughed. Brilliant. and the guy who ran him with his hand up him, he had another one called Spit the Dog, who was a little black bastard who would spit on everybody because it was punk rock times. He would just spit on all the guests, whoever it was, you know, like Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin would come in, you know, and chat with all the kids and stuff, and this dog would just be spitting on him. It was hilarious. And they used to have all these kids in the studio, and their mums and dads would turn up, and they put the mums and dads in a cage, and they would just chuck cream pies at them, water, hose them down, these mums. It was brilliant. And then after a few months, the mums started wearing just T-shirts with no bras on. They were chucked into the cage, and they were hosed down. Suddenly, it was wet T-shirts, and you're a little kid watching this going, fuck me, you can see. And all of a sudden, all the little lads and girls watching it, their dads would suddenly turn up in the front room surreptitiously reading their newspaper while this kids show was on, because they were waiting for the women in the cage to get a soak in for the wet T-shirts. Welcome to England. TV shows.
England's a very exciting place. I didn't realize. Wow. Yeah, for a kids program. That's amazing. I'm not familiar with that.
It's got that TV show was called Tiswas, T-I-S-W-A-S. And on the internet, you can just type that in and you can see little clips of it. It was anarchic. It was brilliant. Everyone was just chucking shit at each other and they'd haul kids around and throw them about all around by the ears, you know, cuff them around the head. It was brilliant.
Yeah, it sounds like it. All right. So for everybody listening, we use fake comic book covers to announce a new episode on the Facebook page and the Facebook group. You can do anything you like. We can't pay you for it. I apologize. But we can use them on there, and if you allow us to, we'll add it to the cover gallery of the blog. A lot of people enjoy these. I'm starting to run thin on them, so I'm a little desperate. Please help a brother out. With guests, when we don't have a guest on the episode, we have a music break. Same thing. If you can put it on an MP3, singing, performance, musicianship. We can't pay you for it as well, but people can listen to it. We'll add you to the music page. And we have a T-shirt. We actually have 3 T-shirts. It's on the sidebar under merchandise. It's just to help us with the hosting fees. Listen to the show. Wear the shirt. And as I said earlier, everything that we've talked about on the episode will be on the blog. Links, images, everything you want to see, just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops. And thank you for listening, everybody. And in the meantime,
read
more
comic books.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Your Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.